And Access All Areas look at one of the most culturally defining apps of the decade, Instagram. Not only responsible for a phenomenal rise in visual storytelling, complete with selfies, food shots and travel logs, but also the creation of a multi-billion dollar industry, complete with digital influencers and personal brands. In the book No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram, Sarah Fryer draws on her interviews with the company's founders, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger, as well as with employees, executives, celebrities and tech competitors like Facebook, which of course is now the owner of Instagram. The result is a detail-packed, rival-rich story. We welcome back Sarah Fryer to 9 to Noon. She's been an occasional tech correspondent for us, but my word, she has been buried deep in this book for quite a while. Sarah, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
It's incredible to think it was only created in 2010, Instagram.
It is incredible because when you look around, as you're walking down the street, as you're watching people celebrate their birthdays, their weddings, their vacations, you can see the impact of Instagram in a way that you can't really see the impact of Facebook and Twitter as much. You can see people choosing to go out of their way to buy and to experience that which is visually shareable, that which gets you this ability to get likes and comments on your feed on Instagram. And the way that the company achieved that cultural impact was incredibly interesting to me, just the way that they designed the product. And so I went about investigating it for my book.
More than a billion people use Instagram each month. Its influence is so far reaching, from ordinary people to the Pope. And of course, influencer has become a whole industry. It is a whole professional business.
There are tens of millions of people who would call themselves influencers, and they can make a living simply by posting on their Instagram on behalf of brands, or in fact, nowadays, building their own brands. And the thing that's really interesting about Instagram compared to the other social networks is that there is no way to reshare the content. So you can't go viral. At the same time, you are only showing on your profile what you have created. So you have created essentially the best place to present the version that you want the world to see. And that's why it became the destination for influencers and brands, because people learned how to get better at getting those likes and comments for their own content. And over time, it just became a performance art.
Which is why it has become a cultural phenomenon. It's beginning to shape our behavior, the way we project ourselves and the way we view others. Absolutely, quite fundamentally.
And it's interesting that also that Instagram, the company, had an opinion about how we should all be acting on their network. They would choose to promote some content over other content, and even would make people famous overnight by posting about them on the @Instagram account, which to this day still has more followers than any Kardashian. And they had this team with an editorial opinion of curating, boosting people, which is very unlike what you hear of from other social networks where they just try to be a neutral reflection of humanity. Instagram really had a hand in shaping what became popular in fashion, in food, in pet content, and all sorts of things.
I'm really curious about the psychology that went into that. It's always an interesting part of these social media stories. The Facebook like button is akin to this, where it's effectively a dopamine hit, drug addiction. And I laugh, but it's interesting how much thought went into the things that so tapped into a fundamental human need that they ended you up with a $100 billion company. If you could put your finger on that one psychological insight that the Instagram founders had, what would it be?
The filters. In the early days, and this may have even been unintentional, at least to the effects that it ultimately had, but in the early days, Instagram founders, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger, realized that people didn't feel like they were good at photography on the iPhone, because the iPhone produced images at that time in 2010 that were grainy or out of focus or with bad lighting. And what Kevin Systrom did with his background in photography is he created these filters that could immediately turn what you had created on your iPhone into something more resembling art, a nostalgia, something that looked more professional. And what that did, in the beginning, it really helped the app catch on. But what that ultimately did is it trained us all to be okay with the idea that what we were putting on the internet was a polished, curated, more perfect version than our life actually was. It gave us permission to pretend a little bit and to build, you know, the personal brand you're talking about, and to go through rolls and rolls of selfies before we find the perfect one, to adjust them with Facetune. Now we don't need those filters anymore, but we are still editing our content, being very aware of which of our angles work the best, which of our colors work the best. And it's given us all this strategic awareness about our online presence. And I think that was just dramatically important in the takeover of Instagram in our culture.
The years of research that you've done into this book included incredible access, actually, to the founders, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger, and others as well. But let's begin with them, who they are, who they were, and what they set about doing. What did they tell you?
They wanted to create a mobile app that would make it very simple to share photography. They created one beforehand called Bourbon, named after Kevin's favorite drink. And it was too complicated. It involved location check-ins, telling your friends you would be somewhere and they could come join you. There were too many factors to it. And they realized that it wasn't catching on, that it wasn't resonating with people. So they went to a whiteboard in their co-working space and decided, of all of the features that we've attempted, which one is the most interesting to people, or which one do people seem to like the most? And can we just do that one thing and do it really well? So they decided photography was the one feature that was catching on. And they decided to build something that was very native just for the mobile phones, because previously everything was everything on mobile, like everything Facebook was doing, for example, was just a copycat of what they were doing on desktop computers. But Instagram was much simpler. And the other thing that they did is they almost invented the influencer industry before it existed. They would get people to use their app when it was very new, who were artists or creatives or people with large followings on Twitter. And they would invite them to join before regular people had the chance to join. And then once everyone started to use Instagram, they would see it as a place for really high quality, really interesting personal content. And that's how we were all taught to use the app, is by looking at what those musicians and artists and photographers were doing in the early days.
What were their individual skills? Systrom, I think, had been pretty close to getting on the ground floor in both Facebook and Twitter, but actually chose to go neither, to go to neither of them. What was his skill set? Where was he at the time?
He was something of a Renaissance man. He had skills, minimal skills in computer programming. In fact, he got a pretty mediocre grade in the only computer programming class he ever took at Stanford University. But he was really interested in photography, really interested in architecture, really interested in coffee and wine and Italian leather. He had just a really varied obsessions with DJing. And he ended up working, it was such a small world at that time in Silicon Valley. He ended up working through this entrepreneurship program at Stanford as an intern at Odeo, which became Twitter. And then as an early employee at Google. And before he even did that, he was asked by Mark Zuckerberg, a very young Mark Zuckerberg, just starting the Facebook.com, if he would come do something with photos for Facebook. And none of those places seemed to fit him quite well, because he wasn't really a hacker. He wasn't really the typical Silicon Valley nerdy engineer. He had interests in in being a lot more social and being a lot more. And so ultimately, those experiences, meeting those people, working for those people, taught him that it really can be anyone who starts a company, as long as they have an insight into human behavior and are able to build a minimally viable product that people might use. From there, you can join up with somebody like Mikey Krieger, who was a Brazilian immigrant who had actually a lot more engineering experience, and partner up with them and then build something that people might like. So it was really interesting and unique background, both in the connections that he had, but also in his interests.
In fact, those interests would often be reflected in who got Insta promoted in the early days. And they were often artisans and artists in the early days. Come back to their intentions, though. Did they want world domination, the way a Zuckerberg perhaps did? What did they want to build? And second... you go ahead with that first.
Well, they wanted to be successful. They wanted to build something that would be universally used, but they didn't have the same edge for competition as Facebook did. And the way that I explain this in the book is Kevin Systrom, he's the ultimate self-improver. He's trying to get the best people to teach him how to do his cycling, the best people to teach him how to do his coffee. He wants to become personally better at everything that he does, which is why he created this app full of interesting people that we can follow and emulate and learn from. And Mark Zuckerberg wanted to be better than everybody else. He wanted to be the winner of the entire market. He would shout domination at the end of his early Facebook employee meetings. And he was fiercely competitive, including with Instagram. And the way that those personalities clashed at Facebook when Instagram was acquired in 2012 was very fascinating, because Facebook was all about incrementally increasing our attention paid to their app. They would send us a lot of notifications. They would track whatever we were doing through their data, whether we were scrolling and sitting on an image or things that we typed and didn't send. They would track everything. And Instagram was more about setting a taste and curating and being a place that was more aspirational, the destination. And they didn't think that they should be using those spammy growth tactics. They thought that they were cheap, that they would lose trust with their users. And so they actually rejected a lot of those lessons from Facebook. So ultimately, Instagram was able to not only get quite large, but borrow some of Facebook's lessons, but not the ones that they thought were against their vision. But that Zuckerberg jealousy would come back to haunt them at the end of the story.
We'll come to that. It's interesting, though, that you make the point that some of this seemed to be about Systrom's own personality traits being reflected in his product. Was it less of what we saw? I think of the ex-Facebook president, Sean Parker, saying, look, from the start, we knew this like button would be addictive. We knew there was a vulnerability in human psychology, and we went after it. With Instagram, the criticism is often that we sort of falsify our realities, and we end up comparing with a perfection that no one has, comparing ourselves to others, and no one has the perfection that we project. Was there ever that intent to exploit that human vulnerability, or was it more a reflection of Systrom's own, life force and personality?
Well, Systrom himself was a person who, he's very diplomatic. He's very good at presenting himself to people. He's self-deprecating. He's likable. He was basically always performing and curating on his Instagram. He would post his fancy cocktails. He would post his scuba trips off the coast of Italy. He would show off on. And so when he would see that behavior on the app, it wasn't really that concerning to him until they started to learn at Instagram around 2015 that teenagers were not posting as much. And what they learned was that Instagram was a place where there was so much pressure to perform that people that it was actually bad for business, that people didn't want to post as frequently unless they had something really spectacular to post about, or unless they could post the most beautiful kinds of images. And so what happened then is Systrom did realize that perhaps there was too much pressure on Instagram, but he thought for a while that the pressure was fine. He ultimately cared more about the bullying, about people saying mean things to each other on the platform. He cared about that because celebrities would complain about it to him. He cared about making sure that there was a way for people to delete comments that were negative or harassing via keyword. But even that is about cleaning things up to make them look better than they actually were. And I don't think that he ever felt like there was a big problem with that performance aspect of it. And when I've asked him about it, he said, well, everyone's just striving to build their business, and that's what they should be doing.
Sarah Fryer is our guest. We are talking about her book on the foundation of Instagram, the story of Instagram. It's No Filter, the inside story of Instagram. She's had remarkable access to its founders and to many others as well as part of her research for the book. 23 minutes past 10, it is on 9 to noon. Well, you alluded to it quite early in its career. Zuckerberg came back for another go. And where was Instagram at the time he made his play again to buy it?
Instagram was still so small. They had 13 employees. They had no revenue to speak of, no business model, but they were rapidly increasing the amount of users that were coming to the platform. They had about 25 million users, and they were growing exponentially. And when Zuckerberg decided to offer $1 billion for Instagram, nobody had ever offered that for a mobile application before. It was unheard of, especially for something with no revenue. But he understood that eventually that Instagram would continue to grow and that it would eventually become a threat to Facebook's dominance. Remember, I said he is incredibly annoyed about the inevitable fade of Facebook. And so he knew that he needed to either join with them or crush them. And it wasn't clear that Facebook would be able to crush them because Facebook was not very good at making applications for mobile phones at that time. So in early 2012, over a whirlwind Easter weekend, Zuckerberg makes the bid, and Instagram had previously turned down overtures from Twitter, but Facebook actually had the potential to solve a lot of their problems because they had so few employees. They really didn't have a way to serve the mounting demand from people on their servers, on their content moderation, on all sorts of aspects of their business. They were very crushed by all of the popularity. And so they thought that Facebook would be best served to help them in that regard. But it was a long time before the deal was approved.
It was worth $1 billion then. What's it worth now?
Instagram is now worth upwards of $100 billion per analyst estimates, and they contribute $20 billion of Facebook's 2019 revenue, and it's only going up from there.
They stayed with the company even after it was sold to Facebook, Systrom and Krieger, and how did that go?
They stayed for 6 years, but at the very end of their tenure at Facebook, Zuckerberg started to feel paranoid about Instagram's potential to take attention away from Facebook. He called it cannibalization, that Instagram would get so popular that people would choose between spending time on Facebook and spending time on Instagram. And Zuckerberg decided that he would prefer for people to be spending their time on Facebook. So he asked the Instagram founders to redirect their users to Facebook. He asked them to increase the amount of advertising that they put into Instagram. He asked them to stop receiving a lot of their resources from Facebook, whether it was headcount for employees or free advertising on the Facebook newsfeed, links from Facebook newsfeed to Instagram. He actually cut a lot of those things off. And so after a while, the founders understood that they were no longer really building a company within a company, this independent entity that Zuckerberg promised they would have. in fact, they were just a mere department of Facebook serving the needs of the larger social network. And that's a very frustrating place for an entrepreneur to be. So they left.
He was the one that got away in terms of the interviews that you did manage to get for this book, Mark Zuckerberg. I think you've done previous interviews with him, actually. Why would he not talk to you for this book?
One thing that I learned in my reporting for this book, you know, I've spent my entire career covering companies, and I've always tried to understand what's happening next. Where are they going? What are they going to decide to do? How is it going to affect their users? The great thing about writing a book is that you get to think about how things happened the way they did and why they happened that way, and dig into people's emotional state and their motivations and what they were insecure about and why they did what they did. Zuckerberg, he's got his own holdups about this situation and how it ended, and I don't think that he was excited about talking about Instagram and having a book be made about Instagram. I'm sure that if it were up to Zuckerberg, my book would be subtitled "The Inside Story of Instagram by Facebook." Right? He wants all of our love for Instagram to trickle into Facebook and help build up the Facebook brand, and I don't know that he thought that I would help achieve that for him, although we have spoken with each other many times in the past. Now, that's just my guess as to his thinking. What I do know is he sent me one quote for this book. He said that his reason for buying Instagram was simple, that he saw its potential for growth. And that really gets to the psyche of Zuckerberg. He cares about growth more than anything else. So while I was disappointed to not get a sit-down interview with him, I was pleased that he basically underlined my thesis about how he thinks about these things.
As part of your research, you spoke to some very powerful people, the hedge fund billionaire Ray Dalio, Anna Wintour of Vogue, Kris Jenner of the Kardashian-Jenner empire. What were you wanting to learn from them?
I wanted to understand how Instagram integrated into their lives and careers. Kris Jenner we think of her as a reality television star, which she is, but she's also a pretty innovative entrepreneur with how her family decided to use Instagram. She built a media empire through the app, and her family was among the first in Hollywood to really understand its potential. So I wanted to see what she saw that other people didn't. And what she did see was the potential to actually increase the affinity with your fans through sharing more of your own life. That when you share, if you're a celebrity, when you share things that happen to you, you build a relationship with your audience that's more like a friendship. And in fact, people are more likely to buy things from friends than they are from a brand. And so by using the Instagram audience, Kim Kardashian could ask people what color her boxes for her perfume should be. And then they would say, you know, they should be purple. And then Kim would make perfume in purple boxes. There was this kind of exchange, giving her fans buy-in into the future product. And a lot of the other A-list celebrities would call up Kris Jenner and say, why are you doing that? I mean, aren't you worried that if you share too much of your life, that people would think that you're less mysterious, that maybe you become less famous? Especially actors were concerned that if they shared more of their intimate lives, that people would be unable to imagine them as their characters in movies and TV shows. And Kris Jenner just said, well, no, I mean, if you really do want to build a brand, if you do want to build a business off of your fans, then this is the way to do it. So I just thought that was very interesting. Anna Wintour, you know, fashion is one of the industries that was very cut off to the rest of the world. It was not accessible to regular people, and it was also very slow. People would do photo shoots, and they would come out 6 months later in a fashion magazine, and there wasn't this kind of momentum that we see today. And what Anna Wintour was able to see is that there were street photographers that were taking, that were changing the conversation on Instagram. They were already taking pictures. They were already having these discussions about brands on the platform. And that's a place that Vogue needed to be if they were going to survive in this digital landscape. So I thought that those people, I wanted to tell a story, not just of the internal decisions made by the company and its employees, but also the people who made it what it is today in other ways.
Capitalism meeting ego, it's been described as, or you could say the ultimate brand promoter. On the downside, though, the criticisms come that it's created a problem where Insta users are sharing their lives but not really living them. There's one image I've seen shared that has, it's a meme actually, and it has, you know, someone standing on a beautiful mountaintop somewhere in New Zealand with all the glorious scenery behind them, and then it says, but in front of them, and shows you the queue all the way down the track waiting to take the same photo. And so, yeah, it looks like it's all remote and isolated, but actually there's a queue of people waiting to take their Insta photos. I suppose this is just, it is part of our modern world that we curate, that we capture and record things in great detail. But did you speak to anyone about the downsides of that, and that we're spending so much time artificially creating things rather than experiencing them?
Oh, absolutely. I actually talked to a psychiatrist in Silicon Valley who was very concerned, not just about this performative aspect, but about how people linked their performance on Instagram or their potential to perform on Instagram with the past success in their lives. These Stanford students who told her that they were worried that if they didn't have an interesting enough Instagram account, that they wouldn't get into the right fraternities on campus. And if they didn't get into the right fraternities on campus, who knows if they would have the right kind of network to get a job upon graduation that they felt they deserved. And people who would say, like, oh, if I don't have an interesting enough Instagram, who will date me? And so people put intense amounts of pressure on themselves to perform and to curate this image. And it has become something of a benchmark of success in our society, which can be damaging, because if you don't understand the games that are played to get to that point, you are sitting there, you're comparing yourselves to other people, and you don't have all the information. You're only seeing the beautiful isolated photo on the top of the cliff. You're not seeing the queue that they waited 2 hours in order to take that photo. You're not seeing how they face-tuned their face to get that perfect perfect glowing skin that is just unattainable. You don't understand that you shouldn't measure yourself up to that level. And so I think that in talking to people who efforted this, you see the downsides pretty clearly. One photographer told me that people who are trying to make it now on Instagram are finding that they're just not getting the likes that they used to get. They're not getting the comments that they used to get. And they think that they're bad photographers. Like, what is it about my content that's not resonating anymore? What they don't understand is how the algorithm works now, or they don't understand that all of their competitors are using comment pods or buying comments or buying engagement, and they're not playing a game on a level playing field. So I think that it is very harmful, and that we need to understand these factors so we can give ourselves a little bit of a break.
Finally, you talked about Mark Zuckerberg's paranoia being what would replace Facebook. What do you see as the life spans of both Facebook and Instagram, which it purchased? We'll put aside the complications of whether any future regulator looks to split them. But, you know, as far as their users are concerned, do they have a threat coming over the horizon?
Well, currently, with the dawn of the coronavirus, people are using Facebook more than ever. People are breaking records on Facebook and Instagram, especially on aspects like live and messaging, using it more than they do on major holidays and peaks in traffic of the past. I think that as we stay home, we're recognizing that the social media platforms we thought we could avoid are now part of our social infrastructure, for better or for worse. Now, when we all go back to work and back to our lives, it's hard to say what will change about that. I think the biggest risk to Instagram is this fatigue I talked about, the fatigue of performing, of pretending like life is better than it actually is. But in fact, even now I'm seeing that change because people don't have vacations to post about. They don't have weddings to post about as much as they did in pre-pandemic times. I think with Facebook, their biggest obstacle is always themselves. I mean, they haven't really been able to build a product that resonates within the company. And because of all of the concern on antitrust, it's going to be difficult for them to acquire the next Instagram. And so they're going to have to invent what the future of social media looks like. And if they're unable to do that, well, then you might see competitors like TikTok gain ground and gain attention.
Sarah, thanks very much for that. Good to talk, and I hope we will again. Thanks very much. Sarah Fryer, and her book is No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. She's drawn on interviews with the founders, Kevin Systrom, Mike Krieger, and a host of others.